So my name's Nick O'Day, and I'm presenting about the search for Posner clusters, which are calcium phosphate compounds relevant to quantum processing in the brain. My project falls under the field of quantum biology, which seeks to answer how much quantum mechanics is active in biological systems. For example, it's theorized that in birds, birds use quantum mechanically entangled electron spins to sense the Earth's magnetic field, helping them navigate their thousands of mile migrations. In plants, it's theorized that superpositions of excited states affect energy transfer in photosynthesis. And in people, it's theorized that quantum mechanics plays a role in our brains. My presentation today will be about investigating a model for quantum processing in the brain using nuclear spins. The main quantum mechanical topic that I'll be talking about with regard to this model is entanglement, which is a non-local correlation. The typical example is in a spin singlet, in which the spins are perfectly anti-correlated. That means if we measure one of them to be spin up, we'll see the other one to be spin down. And this correlation persists even when these spins are spatially separated. This is important for the model because the model theorizes away from going from these quantum mechanical correlations to correlated neuron firing. However, entanglement's pretty fragile, which means that if these particles interact with their environment, they can lose these correlations. That's one of the reasons why in this model we're looking at nuclear spins, because nuclear spins are more resilient to interactions with the environment. And so this leads to the question of which common biological elements nuclear spin might be involved in quantum information processing. And so I have up the 6 most common nuclear spins, and right off the bat, or 6 most common elements in the body as candidates, and right off the bat we can cross off carbon, oxygen, and sulfur because they don't have nuclear spin. We can cross off nitrogen because it's spin 1, which makes it interact more strongly with the environment. And that leaves us with hydrogen and phosphorus as candidates. And for phosphorus, Dr. Fisher identified 2 critical mechanisms for the quantum involved with the quantum brain. The first mechanism relates to enhanced protection of these nuclear spin entanglement. And the second mechanism is related to going from correlated nuclear spins to correlated neuron firing. And so both of these mechanisms are associated with a calcium phosphate compound called a Posner cluster. And it has several nice properties for the quantum brain model. One of them is that the calcium and oxygen are spin 0, so they don't have nuclear spins with which to interact with the phosphorus nuclei. And furthermore, the Posner cluster tumbles rapidly in water, blurring out interactions with the outside environment. Finally, the calcium in the cluster is relates back to the brain. The presence of calcium can cause the release of neurotransmitters, which can cause neurons to fire. It's theorized that the nuclear spin states of phosphorus can affect the orbital angular momentum of the cluster and affect its chemical reaction rates. If, say, the cluster were to dissolve, it would release calcium and could cause neurons to fire. And so if we can get correlations between Posner clusters arising from quantum mechanical entanglement, that gives us a mechanism for going from these correlated nuclear spins to correlated neuron firing. To test this model, Josh and I are checking the conditions under which these clusters can exist in solution. And it's tricky because these clusters are just around a nanometer in size, and they tend to aggregate in high concentrations. The technique that Josh and I are using to try and figure out what kinds of solutions they exist in is called dynamic light scattering. Dynamic light scattering looks at the motion of solutes in solution to figure out their size. And to get a feel for this, you can imagine that solute molecules are bouncing around in solution, and the smaller ones are bouncing around faster. And you can write this mathematically in terms of the diffusion constant of these particles. The diffusion constant's inversely proportional to their radius. So if we learn about particle motion, we can figure out what the sizes of particles are and use that as a characterization technique. So the way that we figure out about motion is by shining laser on the solution and looking at scattered light off of the solutes. That scattered light will fluctuate in time. And typically, if the particles are moving faster, the light will be fluctuating more quickly. And so we learn about those fluctuations with an autocorrelation function, which tells us how the intensity at the detector changes in time. The faster the intensity at the detector changes, the faster this autocorrelation function drops off. And so the theoretical form of this autocorrelation function has an exponential decay, and the time constant's related to the radius of the particles. So by fitting an exponential fit to this autocorrelation function, we're able to get a size distribution for particles. And the smaller particles will have decays that are earlier, and larger particles will have decays that occur at longer times, because the larger particles are moving slower, and thus the intensity at the detector is changing less. Now, this is a sample that Josh and I were looking at that had a couple nanometer-sized protein inside of it. It doesn't have Posner clusters. It's not something that we would want to have Posner clusters in it, but rather it's something that we're checking to see that we can go down to this small size scale with this technique and actually size things at a nanometer scale. And I have up the filtered and unfiltered versions of the exact same sample, and you can tell that the autocorrelation functions are very different. The unfiltered sample has a much later decay time, which is characteristic of larger particles. And the reason for that is that dust particles in the solution are going to be much larger than the samples we're looking at. For example, a 100 nanometer speck of dust is 100 times as large as what we're looking for. And the intensity of light scattered off of small particles goes as their radius to the 6th power. That means that a 100 nanometer dust speck scatters light a trillion times more strongly than a 1 nanometer Posner cluster. And so a single dust speck in our solution can strongly warp these autocorrelation functions. So that means that Josh and I have to work on making our samples as clean as possible. Here's an autocorrelation function looking at a simulated body fluid that's supposed to mimic human body fluid. And we're trying to see if Posner clusters might be present in such a fluid. And our filtered sample, you can tell, is extremely flat. It's very difficult to see the decay. And the reason for that is that when we have these small particles that scatter so little, scattering off of water can become comparable to scattering off of the particles. And that will typically flatten out this autocorrelation. And in order to remedy this, we need to have very high quality data so that we can zoom in to that decay and be able to fit what the particle sizes are. In order to do that, Josh and I are working on longer runs in the dynamic light scattering apparatus. But I mentioned that a single dust speck can completely warp an autocorrelation function. So that means that we have to be able to run our samples for well over an hour without a single piece of dust floating in our solution across the laser's beam. In order to do that, Josh and I have put together a filtration system that can filter our sample within the dynamic light scattering apparatus itself, reducing exposure to air and helping us get this technique to push this technique to the limit, helping us be able to size particles that are a nanometer or smaller. And that's what we'll be working on in the coming weeks. This is critical for being able to size a Posner cluster and tell if it's present in solution or not, which brings us back to the quantum brain model. The Posner cluster is important because it protects the nuclear spins of phosphorus nuclei, which in turn can affect chemical reaction rates in the brain and lead to correlated neuron firing, making the Posner cluster a critical piece of this model. And so the coming weeks, we're hopeful that we're going to be able to get to the size scale of the Posner cluster and see under which conditions they exist. I'd like to thank the people who made this possible, especially the Worcester family for funding my research this summer. And thank you for listening.
Can you go two slides back, maybe three? So I don't know too much about the body here. What kind of body fluid are you simulating? Is it the fluid that the brain senses?
So it could be something like extracellular fluid. This is mostly a mixture of calcium, phosphoric acid, and some salt to help prevent the Posner clusters from aggregating. And the reason we're doing that is we're looking at simple systems first to make sure that we don't get maybe signal from other things in the sample. And then furthermore, around 20 years ago, there was a study done that investigated Posner clusters, or specifically small calcium phosphate clusters. And so we've been trying to reproduce some of those results that they had in sizing.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Has there been consideration for testing like tubulin proteins for their aromatic ring nuclear spins?
I see. Are you talking about the symmetry of it? So I had mentioned that the Posner cluster was nice because correlated nuclear spins could lead to correlated chemical reactions. One of the mechanisms for that has to do with the symmetry of the Posner cluster and looking at fermion exchange under rotation. And so the question asked was about if there might be things like aromatic rings that also had symmetries that could be used, say, in a quantum brain. And so I don't believe that those would necessarily have the coherence times that we would need in order for a feasible quantum brain model.
I have a quick question. So you mentioned how these you fit these to exponentials. Could you maybe explain the red data here? And why there's maybe on the next
yeah
and why there's that extra hump.
So probably a couple reasons. It can be different pieces of dust in the solution, and typically a single piece of dust floating in front of the laser beam will warp the autocorrelation function and make it so that it doesn't necessarily have a clear exponential decay, because that's no longer described by, say, particles just bouncing around. It's if it's like no dust, and then suddenly this spike in our counts from a dust particle passing in front, that doesn't follow the same exponential pattern. You can get there can be issues as well in the correlation if it, say, like passes out of the beam very quickly.
Thank you.